This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Arthur Sulzberger Jr., has been the publisher of the New York Times since 1992 and has also been chairman of the New York Times since 1997. He's a member of the fourth generation of his family to run the paper. His great-grandfather, Adolf Oakes, bought the Times in 1896. Sulzberger was named Publisher of the Year last month by Editor and Publisher magazine. The editorial explaining the choice said, "Arthur Sulzberger Jr. certainly had the benefit of every advantage that comes with membership in one of the foremost newspaper families in the world. He easily could have managed to maximize profits and enrich both the family and the shareholders. Instead, he has revamped the organization, flattened the management structure, diversified the staff, moved boldly into digital media, and made the Times more accessible to a wider range of people other than white upper-crust New Yorkers. The results are impressive. Circulation is up, profits at record levels." Sulzberger took over the paper just as the internet was about to transform publishing. I think many journalists and editors agree that some stories are very important, but not necessarily popular. Some stories are very important to cover, but they won't necessarily attract a large readership. For example, certain international stories with countries that most people couldn't even find for you on the map. They're important stories. They're not going to be the most widely read ones. On the internet, you can actually analyze exactly how many hits each page has had. So you can really tell how popular a story is, whether it's being read or not, how many people are reading it. I'm wondering how you're letting that guide, if at all, your decisions about how much time to spend, how much space to give to a news story now.
It's a very important question, and one that we've grappled with not only since the time of the internet, but for years. Because while the internet gives you the ability to do that on a daily basis, the truth of the matter is that polling has given you a chance to do that on a regular basis for years. And in fact, when we were working in the late 80s and early 90s to rethink the Times, we did work research into what people were looking for, what were they interested in, how did they read the paper, and all of that information flowed up to the senior management team of the paper, and here's the simple way we look at it. We're going to give people stories on hunger in Somalia, whether they want it or not, because that is our responsibility to them and to democracy. And I've yet to see a research report that's ever has a reader saying, "I really want more on the hunger in Somalia," or any of the stories akin to that. That's our job, and we're going to give that regardless of what people tell us. Now, when it comes to remaking the living section or weekend, there we have more flexibility. And if we discover that people really aren't interested in one area of coverage that we thought was important, but they're very much interested in another area that we didn't wasn't quite on our radar screen, well, we will adapt to that. Now, we're still obviously going to cover, just to take culture for a moment, we're still going to cover the theater and Broadway. We're still going to cover the music scene of jazz, which is not nearly as popular as other music, because that's part of who the New York Times is, of who we are. So you learn intuitively inside yourself where to listen and where it's inappropriate to listen. And that's why, you know, despite what everyone, what you're seeing around the around this country in what is, I think, a clear shift away from foreign coverage, we actually have more foreign bureaus and foreign reporters than we used to.
What are some of the most interesting things you've learned from surveys about readers and how they read your paper? Things that have led to what you consider to be good changes?
They don't make jumps the way we always thought they jumped from a page one story. I think that came as a little bit of a shock. You really got to have a compelling piece for them for many of our readers to jump to the inside pages.
So we're
writing briefer. Our stories are generally shorter. Now, do we still do major takeouts? Of course we do. But in a time when people really do say that they are pressed for time, you better be sure the story is very compelling.
So does this mean you're trying to condense more in the front page?
No, I don't think it means that. We're not trying to condense more in the front page. We're just, we're being more judicious in our use of space.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Arthur Sulzberger Jr., the publisher of the New York Times. Why did you want to go into the family business?
I wasn't talented enough to do anything else. If you don't accept that answer, I actually wasn't... I took it step by step. From the age of five, when I finally got over wanting to be a fireman, I went into, a high school newspaper side. I didn't wind up becoming the editor of the paper, but one of the senior editors. I stayed out of it in college. I wasn't even part of the college newspaper. And then jumped into it when I graduated and discovered, to my joy, that I really liked it. I loved reporting. I loved writing. And thought I'd make a career on the news side.
What was it like reading the paper when you were growing up and knowing that, you know, your family owned and published the paper? I mean, you must have felt a certain connection.
Well, first of all, I'm going to confess now that I wasn't one of those remarkable children who, at the age of seven, picks up the New York Times and settles down into an armchair. I think my first paper was perhaps the Daily News, and it wasn't until I got into high school that I started to really read the paper in depth. Because, quite frankly, until late in high school, junior, senior year, it wasn't that critical to my life. It only became more critical as you become, in my case, politically aware. Those are the days of the Vietnam War and the demonstrations, and the Times became, you know, an important tool to grow personally.
Did you feel like a traitor bringing the Daily News into your house?
No, of course not. I mean, any more than no. In fact, I think my father subscribed to it. I think I read it there. If you read newspapers and if you love newspapers, you just don't read one. At least I don't. And we subscribe, for example, at home to the Wall Street Journal. That's one of the joys of this business. It just doesn't have to be the New York Times.
What was the biggest newspaper or family crisis you remember from your childhood?
I think that would have to be the Pentagon Papers and my father having to fly back from London on the overnight plane to get back into this country because we just published the Pentagon Papers and the government was going crazy.
What's the closest you've come to having to decide what to publish? The closest to the Pentagon Papers. What's the closest? Yeah, sorry.
It has to be the. That's okay. It has to be. Well, it's a good question. Joe Lilienfeld was asked this question recently, and our executive editor, and he actually responded that that it was the presidential impeachment story and Monica Lewinsky and how we covered all of that. And I think from his perspective, from managing the newsroom on a day-to-day basis with a running story that was really pushing the envelope of what the New York Times was comfortable with, that's absolutely the right answer. But in my case, as publisher, the Unabomber would be the moment where it was most critical as to whether or not we were going to publish something.
The Unabomber had sent, I think, you and the Washington Post letters basically saying that if you published his manifesto, he'd stop killing.
That's correct, and he gave us a lot of, thank goodness, a lot of time to make that decision as to whether or not we were going to publish either the Post or the Times or perhaps in unison. Certainly gave us time to come to some agreement internally at both papers, and then to come to an agreement with each other and of course with the Justice Department and the FBI, at least giving us some guidance and advice.
Yeah, you I don't know if it was you personally, but the Times. Took the letter to the FBI and the Justice Department and talked with them about the pros and cons of actually giving in to this demand and publishing the manifesto. What kind of discussion did you have before even bringing it to the Justice Department and the FBI? Discussion about whether it was appropriate to ask them about a news decision?
No, I didn't I don't think any of us felt it was inappropriate to ask. We often seek advice. Uh-huh. It would have been inappropriate to be told. what to do. And the Justice Department, to their credit, they never once told us what to do. They worked with us by giving us information. We also had people from the outside giving us information. But I think it's fair to say that when Don Graham and I walked in to meet with the Attorney General on that last meeting, we both knew that we were inclined, unless the Justice Department said, "No, we don't think you should do this," we were inclined to publish it. The fact is, they then asked us to, so it was really a meeting of the minds.
Did you have any reservations about publishing it?
Oh, of course, I had reservations. How could you not have reservations? But I think the reservations were outweighed by the positive nature of what we thought we were doing. And in fact, as you know, it did indeed uncover who he was, and he was captured.
Is that because the brother read it in the Times or
he read it in the Washington? He read it in the Washington. The Washington Post wound up printing it, mm-hmm. Although that was a joint decision by the Times and the Post, and we covered half the costs. But we decided to only choose one paper in which to print it, and for reasons I'm not going to get into, we chose the Washington Post.
So the brother read it in there and recognized that this was probably his.
That's
his brother was probably the Unabomber.
That's right.
I think the big fear in doing something like this is that it's going to start a trend where other people say, "Well, I'll stop committing murder if you publish my manifesto."
Right. I consider this the New York Times plan for world peace. If every murderer and every terrorist group agreed that they would no longer murder or terrorize, I will open up these pages, and we'll just in a couple of years, the world will be a truly better place. That sounds a little cynical, but in truth, this was not some guy who was saying he was going to kill somebody. This was somebody with a clear track record of murdering people and maiming people. And we had reasons to believe that he was also, and this will sound a little odd, a man of his word. And that, in truth, he was going to stop if we published it. So there were two or three different things at play here. But it was not an easy decision. And the brain trust we collected at the New York Times when we first sat down to discuss it was all over the map. Some people felt that we had no choice but to publish it. Others felt that it would be the absolute wrong decision to publish it. And by the end of the process, by the end of the month or two that we worked on this issue, we were unanimous in our decision.
Has anyone else written you and said, "I will stop doing this if you publish my manifesto or my article"? Have there been any copycats?
Not that's made it to me.
My guest is Arthur Sulzberger, Jr., publisher of the New York Times. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Arthur Sulzberger, Jr., publisher of the New York Times. Now, in your early years in newspapers, you worked... Let's see, you worked at a paper in North Carolina, you worked
right.
for the Associated Press in London, you worked for the Times in many positions at the Metro Desk as a foreign correspondent.
Not as a foreign correspondent.
No, as a foreign
I was the Washington correspondent for the New York Times, but never a foreign correspondent.
And I think you worked in the advertising department for a while.
Advertising, production, mm-hmm. yeah.
Were you consciously trying to groom yourself to become publisher and learn everything you could about each aspect of the paper?
Probably. The big shift was really from the news side to the business side. And I must confess, I took that step with a lot of trepidation. I had a wonderful, I guess, almost a decade working as a reporter or editor for newspapers or wire services, and I loved that world. I didn't know whether or not I was made for the world of business. So when I moved to the advertising department to try my hand at that, I really thought that if it doesn't work, I'll go back to news and make my career there. It turned out that I was I found that the business side as compelling as the news side, and rather enjoyed it. I won't say I was a great ad salesperson, but I learned a lot and kept proceeding. So I'm not sure it's quite as conscious as it sounds. It was a step-by-step process, and I took each job and just tried to enjoy it, and in truth, did.
How do you define your job now as publisher?
Strategy, I think, is the biggest my biggest concern. What is the strategic direction of the newspaper, and what's the strategic direction of the company? Because as I'm publisher of the Times, to be sure, but I'm also chairman of the New York Times Company, and that's a somewhat larger plate. So strategy, personnel, big, you know, where's the next generation of leadership coming from? And continuing to push the organization to become comfortable with things like the internet, with television, with new means of distributing the quality information, and always ensuring that the quality of what we produce is of the highest caliber.
What did you most not want to inherit about your father's life when you watched him running the New York Times?
Strikes.
Why was that the worst thing?
Because strikes suggest that in the end you couldn't find an accommodation between two important points of view. The need for leadership and management of a public company that has to have profits to succeed and grow, and the needs of the workforce, the men and women who are responsible in the end for producing that great newspaper. His was obviously a more difficult time than mine, but I think it's fair to say we found a way to reach greater accommodation. It's not perfect. We still have issues, but it's not quite as volatile as it used to be.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Arthur Sulzberger Jr. is the publisher of the New York Times.